from Social Services SG. I am Jing Yao. We're trying something new today, and it's something we've wanted to do for some time. Together with a new co-host, Estella Ho, we picked a book of interest to discuss and explore. For this episode, the book we've chosen is titled Of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It, by US journalist and scholar Richard Rees. Estella and I first explain why and how we chose the book, share what we liked and didn't enjoy, and draw some Singaporean connections and personal reflections. Estella, we've been wanting to do this for some time, right? We talked about the book and, you know, in my mind, I've been toying with the idea of talking about books because those are really great sources of information. And we've somehow decided and landed on the book that we're going to talk about today, which is titled Of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It. So I thought to kind of set the context first, maybe I'll just read directly from the synopsis first to give, you know, listeners a sense who might not have read the book before, a sense of what the book is about, and then we can dive into it, right? So the book was written by Richard Rees. He's a U.S. journalist. He's also a scholar with the Brookings Institution. And this is what the synopsis says, right? I'm going to read verbatim from the website itself. It says, boys and men are struggling. Profound economic and social changes of recent decades have many losing ground in the classroom, the workplace, and in the family. And while the lives of women have changed, the lives of many men have remained the same or even worsened. Our attitudes, our institutions, our laws have failed to keep up. Conservative and progressive politicians mired in their own ideological warfare failed to provide thoughtful solutions. The father of three sons, a journalist and a Brookings Institution scholar, Richard V. Reeves, has spent 25 years worrying about boys both at home and work. So this new book tackles the complex and urgent crisis of boyhood and manhood. You know, Reeves looks at the structural challenges that face boys and men and offers fresh and innovative solutions that turn the page on the corrosive narrative that plagues this issue. Of Boys and Men argues that helping the other half of society does not mean giving up on the ideal of gender equality. Right? So before, you know, listeners will have, you know, many, many questions about why we chose this book, but maybe to start off, right, Estella, how did you first hear about the book and then what sparked or what piqued your interest in the book?
Yeah, so as you know, I am an Ezra Klein mouthpiece. So I was listening to this episode on the Ezra Klein show, his podcast, and he had invited Reeves as a guest speaker to talk about his book. And because it's about gender equality for men, when I listened to the episode, initial thoughts were, well, like the world is going downhill. Ezra Klein is a conservative. He's basically what Andrew Tate at this point. So it took some time for me, I think, to really get into the content and start to think about it deeper as well and be more receptive to what Reeves was talking about. I'm actually interested to know also what your initial thoughts were, because mine was, as I mentioned, indignation at first, because I think there's been such a backlash in terms of how a lot of men, especially conservative men, have approached or received feminism in especially this era.
Yeah, which you mentioned that Ezra Klein is a columnist. I think he's he's a podcaster, but also a columnist with the New York Times. He's known to be more left-leaning.
He's liberal. He's very liberal.
Yeah, very liberal, right? Left-leaning, progressive. And so I guess I had the same reaction, right? I responded to your Instagram story. I was like, I was listening to the episode as well. And I went into the episode with a lot of apprehension. I was like, why would anyone write a book about this or let alone interview someone who has written a book about it? And so I went into it with a lot of skepticism, but actually listening to the episode made me want to read the book. And my intention of reading the book wasn't to necessarily agree with the author, but to find ways in which I would say, hey, this doesn't seem right. You know, how could it be that in this climate or context when we're still talking about feminism and gender equality, that we're talking about men struggling in that sense as well. So I really went into the book thinking, oh, there are ways in which I can dissect the book, right? But I came into it different. I came away from it very differently, right? Because the book itself, which you share, is structured in kind of five sections, right? So in the first, he talks about the problems that men face in general. So that's the first part. Talks about how it's an education system that favors girls and a labor market that favors men. Talks about class dynamics, then talks about fatherhood. Then he goes on to talk about double disadvantage in the second part. He dives into biology and culture, political stalemate, and then, you know, some policy recommendations in the end as well. What I'm curious, you know, what stood out to you when you read the book besides the podcast itself?
I found it pretty interesting that he focused a lot on intersectionality. So second section of the book, as you mentioned, where he talked about the double disadvantage, not only for men, but also men who maybe are at the bottom of the class ladder or already have other forms of marginalized identities. So for example, if they were from minority racial groups, they would experience a double disadvantage in terms of the labor market or even in terms of education.
Yeah.
I think another thing that also, I guess, piqued my interest and got me to think a bit further was how he dissected the way that the flaws in liberal thinking when it came to things like toxic masculinity, for example, how that sort of is counterproductive and it might even alienate a lot of men from feminism or gender equality as a cause. He also talked about how liberals tend to have this aversion to recognizing biological differences between men and women, because I think so much of policy in the past has been predicated on this sex essentialism. And because of that, I think that aversion has translated into them ignoring these natural variances across the sexes and therefore not adjusting policy to meet men's needs. What about you? I'm interested to know what you thought was interesting.
So there are a few things that stood out, right? And I think this we can kind of go into greater detail in addition to what you mentioned with the double disadvantage, toxic masculinity, and also the point about the political perceptions and the divide based on US politics as well. The other big point, which I think has a lot of relevance to Singapore, is talking about fatherhood and what it means to be a father. Because if it's the case, and we accept it's the case where the labor market favors men and the education system favors women and the domestic sphere is assumed to be the responsibility of women in general, then there's a lot of implications for Singapore. Because I'm thinking now, oh, what does it mean to be a father, or what does it mean to assume responsibilities in the household as a dad? So that's one piece that I think came up. The other one I think that came up really interestingly is the opposite, right? You mentioned the liberal side as well. He was pretty scathing on both sides. So he was quite critical about the conservatives as well, talking about how, you know, how they fuel or how they use male grievances, right? I'm guessing a lot of listeners, when they first see the title of the book or us focusing on it, they'll be like, why are you doing like a Andrew Tate kind of commentary or support, right? But in the book, it's quite explicit in calling out conservatives in weaponizing or using male grievances as political gain, right? Using that as a way to gain electoral support and really being antiquated in the solution. So the solution for the conservatives is that if the modern male is struggling, then the solution will be, oh, then let's go back to what it used to be when, you know, the mothers or women will stay at home. We have our single house, a single income household, just a single male breadwinner. And that stood out also. And I'm guessing we will get into a lot of this. So I thought a nice way to kind of structure our discussion is maybe let's spend the first half to talk about the book itself, right? Let's talk about what we liked, what we didn't like about the book. We've gotten into some of it, but I guess at the second half, we also want to bring the Singapore perspective in, right? In terms of how it relates to the Singapore perspective. And so I thought we could, you know, do that. So maybe let's start this section with a very brief summary of the first two parts or the first six chapters of the book, right? So he lays out a case and, you know, listeners can determine for themselves the extent to which they agree. So he lays out, Reeves lays out the case in the first chapter that there's an education system I mentioned that favors girls, a labor market that favors men. And one thing that he's really fixated upon is a developmental gap with the male prefrontal cortex that struggles to keep up with the female one, especially when one is still in school. So that's the case he makes in the beginning. Then he makes the case about why, or he presents a case as to why there's a persistent pay gap. It's not a new argument. He makes it quite clear that it's about whether you have children or not. Women are disadvantaged at the workplace in terms of pay and and advancement opportunities. There are many different reasons, of course, but a primary one that academics and researchers have settled on is whether you have children or not, right? So the other case he makes is that it is the case where, especially at the top of the economic ladder, there's a lot of catching up for women to do. I don't frame it as catching up. I mean, in terms of societal catching up, right? But lower down the ladder, it's often the men who are struggling. That's the case he's making. He makes a case about dislocated dads. The interesting argument here is that traditionally, a family model is one where, you know, if you are a male breadwinner, you just have to bring in the money, the income, and you have a wife who tends to the house, tends to your children. And, you know, as long as you have that, that's going to be enough, right? But clearly, there's greater recognition that that's not enough as well. He brings up a very important empirical evidence that divorce, which is twice more likely initiated by wives than husbands, is psychologically harder than men than women, which points to a fact that men are psychologically very reliant on their spouses as well. So that's the first case it makes. The other case it makes, which is something you alluded to, is a class ceiling. So the intersectional part is not paying attention to only just sex and gender, but also to the class dynamics as well. So that's something he makes. And he makes the point that for men who are struggling or who have lower socioeconomic status, that's going to be really hard, much harder for them in that sense in the US context. And then finally, he makes the point that we really don't make enough effort in thinking about what the potential solutions are, both on the individual and policy level as well. So what do you think? So what really stood out, or what did you, we talked about what stood out to you, but what did you enjoy most from this first few chapters or throughout the book?
Maybe at this point, it's good to have a disclaimer that we're engaging with this material. So it's very much focused on the cishet male experience compared to the cishet female experience. So although we would love to bring in queer entities here, I think just to keep to the integrity of the book, we'll be engaging the research that relates to those entities more. What I found quite thought-provoking about the first part, I think, was that he sort of married the differences in neurological development with the way that boys are struggling more than girls in engaging in the education system. And I guess pointing out how the structure currently favors girls more than boys. I think we've all been through the education system and we have seen instances of this play out. I think it's really putting that into that framework that really helped me understand why that was the case. I think you tend to see boys maybe being less conscientious about their homework,
yep,
or maybe falling behind in school a bit more than girls, and girls being sort of made out to be more mature than boys. And I think boys sometimes are penalized for that a lot, even though it's something they can't help. So I think that's something that was interesting to me that he pointed out. And he also talked about how the gap sort of widens in university as well, at least in the States, and it is in the context of the US. And that also translates to not only fewer men enrolling into college, but also fewer men graduating from college, even if they have enrolled. And I think we did a bit of research on the Singapore context. I think in terms of maybe primary and secondary school education, it's pretty similar in terms of enrollment and completion rates. But university is where I think there's a bit of divergence happening as well that could follow trends in the States in the next couple of years.
Yeah, it's interesting because the first thing, so he's quite fixated upon the biology and culture point, right? I mean, he has three main recommendations. The very first recommendation he has in response to that is that, oh, so the solution here, okay, let's give boys one more year in pre-K so that they will start elementary school or primary school in our context like 1 year later, right? But in my mind, I was like, that's in a way kind of how much later, but how national service works in Singapore, because boys, exactly, men will go 2 years later, right? So you assume, or he would be maybe interested in a context of Singapore where maybe it's the case where, you know, I don't know if we have the data for this, but like boys or men do comparable to girls and women at colleges, right? But yeah, he's very fixated on the biology and culture point, right? To the extent where this is his very first recommendation to change to address the gap in that sense. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that because I know we'll get into a conversation about NS later on, because there is no conversation about gender equality that doesn't involve NS in Singapore.
Yeah.
But when he talked about the the biological and neurological differences between boys and girls, I was like, oh, that justifies anything.
Yep.
It doesn't, but it was an interesting point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the second part about the labor market was also interesting because he sort of differentiated the pay gap versus, I guess, how the rate of employment between men and women. So as you mentioned, women do face a pay gap and they are penalized for pregnancy, the pregnancy penalty. But I think he also mentioned how men are also losing ground in the labor market. And that's because a lot of them are employed in jobs which are now being automated.
Yep.
So women are, I think, traditionally employed more in jobs that require more of a human touch, and therefore their jobs are more shielded from this wave of automation that's happening. And one of his policy recommendations is for men to go into more health administration, education, and literacy jobs. Sorry, I got the order wrong, but it's supposed to spell out the acronym of HEAL.
Yeah, yeah, right, yeah.
Which is sort of not antithetical or like the direct opposite of STEM, but I guess you could classify those as those two binaries that in terms of the job market.
Yeah, and that also ties into the first thing you reflected on, which is the solution to have more men in the HEAL positions, like healing positions, right? Like teacher, social worker, psychologist. It's a two-parter, right? The way I see it. The first part is it's important, and I agree with this, where, you know, if you are in a school system, you want some teachers who are also male as well, right? So
it's
hard to put my finger on explaining the mechanisms for it, but you imagine that being beneficial to boys who are male students or boys who are in schools. That's the first part. The other part of it is, and this is where I agree with you, I thought was really compelling from the book, is really that intersection between class and gender or sex, right? Which is making a very explicit claim, as you mentioned. And this was written before AI became what it is right now. It's like really exploded. But even in that context or that time, he made a very strong point, which I completely agree with, is, you know, no matter whether you are, regardless of a sex or gender, being or struggling economically or socioeconomically is really a big deal. And he makes the more explicit point that in the US, that if you are low SES, you're low income, you're likely to be worse off if you are male in that sense, right? He talks about higher rates of suicide. He talks about the fact that it's very different if you don't have the same job prospects, your wages are stagnant or going down. And that also leads to another complication where if so much of your self-worth or your ascribed self-worth is tied to employment and providing for your family, that's going to be really difficult, because if you don't have the same jobs and protections and employment level, then navigating the household part of it will be a really challenging one. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there was one quote that he had in the book where there was an observation made that a man's worth is more tied to what he does than who he is.
Yeah.
And I think that's also coming to like the point about fatherhood and how that role has changed in the last couple of decades with the women's movement as well.
Yeah.
That women's identity is still very much sacred and safe in the family sphere because their role is very much tied to their reproductive capabilities or ability. And for males, that's more tied to what they're able to provide for their family.
Yeah.
So given that now there is, I think, a more equal split in terms of breadwinning capabilities among of the father and the mother in a nuclear family, I think fathers feel like their central role as a breadwinner is being threatened by that, or it's being eroded in some ways. And so what they're able to provide to their family is diminishing over time. So I think because they have such an indirect relationship with their children, often the mother is the one that sort of has a central role in doing caregiving. Now the father feels a bit more dislocated from the family.
And also the fact that women have been entering the workforce and labor force, right? So not only are they still in many circumstances assuming roles and responsibilities in the household, they are also working, right? And one of the examples or quotes that came up in the book, and you know, he uses this in the Christian denomination context, but I don't think it's limited to that context, right? There's this example, and I quote verbatim here. He's talking about this father who is Christian, and this is what he writes. Reeves writes, he says, this particular person or male supports equality, but is part of a Christian denomination teaching that men should be the head of the household. He is torn between being the kind of man he has been told to be and the kind of man the world needs now. And he's not the only one. A common thread running through many of the challenges facing men is the culture shock represented by women's economic independence, right? Now, when I went, an end quote there, but when I read this in relation to what you said, right, I was like, again, it feels like we are babying men and blaming the women, right? Because, oh, it's the fault of women's economic independence. There's not been this process of helping males transition through this process, right? Somehow it was lost. But when I take a step back, I'm like, yes, it is the case where we still blame women a great deal. That's true. But it can also be true where I think a lot of boys and men who grew up in families and traditional family structures or nuclear family structures where roles are delineated very clearly have not been socialized in that way, right? Like, unless, and I would think I'm an exception, right? I grew up in a family where my mom and dad shared the household chores. And obviously, when I'm socialized in a context, I assume that's the norm, that, you know, my dad does the toilets and cook, my mom does everywhere else, right? I thought that was the norm, but clearly that's not. And there is a piece there which I'm, you know, wondering what your experiences have been and, you know, what you thought about the exposition in the book itself.
Yeah, I think there was a quote that I actually wrote down, taken from Reeves, where he says the success of the women's movement has not caused the precariousness of male social identity, but it has exposed it.
Yeah.
But I think one really fascinating point that he brought up as well was that for the 99%, the bottom 99% of women, especially those who also have other more marginalized identities, so for example, like racial minorities or a lower class level, they continue to expect men to be the breadwinners of the family or to earn a higher wage than them, even though these women have entered the workforce and are earning income for the family already. And this comes in a context of these men finding it more difficult to secure higher paying jobs or to even keep work. And that puts even more pressure on the men to maintain that identity in its traditional sense. And I think that's maybe where women have the most role to play in changing the expectations of men going forward, given that so much of their role has changed in the last couple of decades.
Yeah, and the funny thing, and you know, this is, we can mix it, we were going to do it separately, but like a critique of the book, right, which is none of the three solutions, you know, the three solutions we've alluded to, which is the increase, like delaying 1 year for pre-K education, having huge jobs, and then the last one is policies about fatherhood. None of them really get into the crux of the quote you shared, right, which is how do we address this exposed fault line in that sense as well, because as you mentioned too, and I really like the way it was framed, right, which is, it's very crudely framed in the book. It's very insulting, but basically this is what he was citing. Some researchers or sociologists would say that even in poor neighborhoods, right, what happens is that women see fathers or their partners as another mouth to feed, right? So the expectation there is that if I'm a woman, I'm low income in the household, I'm caring for my kids, I have to work. And if my partner isn't, you know, living up to his standards or his end of the bargain, then I am feeding another mouth, right? It becomes another baby I have in the household, which sounds ludicrous, but it seems to be the case anecdotally in a lot of circumstances also, right? And that only raises the bar that males or men are not necessarily used to, right? The socialization piece, I don't think we think about it enough, right? I think about this in the context of oftentimes, again, not taking responsibility away from the man himself or men themselves, but familial kind of structures that enable it, right? I'm thinking about cases where, you know, there's this trope about being mommy's boy, and in relationships sometimes it's the extended family members or the in-laws who enable these to happen, right? That oh, you cannot, you are our elder son or you are male, you shouldn't be doing all these things. Like, you should let your wife do it, right? So I guess the question is, how does that change happen? So how do we wrench ourselves out of that socialized kind of like profiles of what moms and dads should be or what roles males and females or men or women should assume in the household?
Yeah, I think even when it comes to dating, so I wasn't super aware of this, but I think last year when I was having a conversation with a couple of colleagues, they helped me realize how Singaporeans typically date, in that it's very common for women to ask men how much they earn on the first couple of dates. And I think that is really tied to the expectation of you have to be the breadwinner of the family, or you have to at least earn more than me. And it's a different cultural context, but I think that translates from what we just talked about in terms of that those social expectations of men still persisting and being very static across time.
Yeah, and that's tough, right? Because I you know, one can listen to this and say, oh, that makes it harder for men to date, because that means you will really only stand a better chance in that sense if you meet a certain threshold. Obviously, everyone's threshold differs, but implicit in that is that, oh, it's hard in a Singapore context where you have to earn a certain amount before you can think about settling down, right? I do also think that's wrapped up in economic anxiety besides, you know, sex and gender roles as well. But that also complicates, I think, the circumstances for men in Singapore and beyond. Yeah. And I guess the other piece that you mentioned that I want to make sure we get to as well, right, is the point about toxic masculinity, right? So, you know, we talked about socialization in the context of the family or household. A big piece here is the political piece, right? We, you know, in Singapore, we might say we are different from the US context, but I think there's some value in looking at it from the US context, right? So I thought what we could do is, you could, you know, since you mentioned it as well, tell us what you thought of Reese's assessment of the liberal or progressive view. And this is something that came out during the podcast with Ezra Klein, clearly, right? But what do you think about the point he was making about the political stalemate, and in particular the what he terms as progressive blindness in that sense?
Yeah, I think also to put in the context of how it ties together in the book, he points out progressive blind spots because that sort of informs the way policy is made. So for example, with toxic masculinity, he talked about how the progressives tend to pathologize naturally occurring aspects of masculine identity. So for example, things like having a higher sex drive, maybe the way they, I guess in the many ways in which they view or perceive women as well would be different from the way women perceive themselves. And how this whole phenomenon of toxic masculinity has a tendency to alienate men and be very counterproductive in its sense. So even men who are not extreme conservatives, Andrew Tate types, may find this rhetoric very off-putting and therefore have less support for the women's movement because of that. And so that as a whole would undermine feminism. I mean, I think we're seeing sort of a movement against this as well among men, in that a lot of them, even though they are not as extreme, they do express sort of resentment against feminism, and they do see women moving up the corporate ladder, especially, as sort of a zero-sum game, and that something that they used to be more entitled to or more used to is being taken away from them. And that creates this sort of tension between like furthering the women's movement and sort of protecting the what they think is rightfully theirs. There's also the part about blaming the victim, which is something that I didn't mention at first, but I wanted to pick up because I think the language that was used, I found a bit affronting at first, because blaming the victim is typically used when a woman is, I think, has been maybe harassed by a man.
Yep.
And she is being blamed for that harassment. And I think sort of picking and lifting that term to this context is a bit not disingenuous, but I don't think it's as accurate, because in this sense, when a man is sort of called out for his bad behavior, he is a perpetrator in some sense. He's not just purely the victim. He did commit an action based on personal agency. And I think the question is then, how do we make space for corrective actions that also take into account systemic failures or systemic flaws? And I think that's something that hasn't been brought up in Reese's book at all, in terms of the policy recommendations that he has, in that he's very much of the stance that we shouldn't be putting this much pressure or expectations on men to be this gold standard. But at the same time, it doesn't leave a lot of room for us to recognize personal agency on the part of men in perpetrating all these harmful stereotypes or harmful behaviors. So I think that's something that I found a bit lacking in the book. I'm not sure what you think of that.
Yeah, I agree, right? So I think the I broadly agree with the notion where we tend to, or rather, when we look at problems that men or boys go through, we tend to individualize them, even though we've talked about extensively about how there are social and structural changes that have not kept up with the narratives that we have for boys and men in general. I think that's a challenge. I think the broad liberal or progressive problem that he moots, I broadly agree with, right? So in a sense where he agrees that progress made for women has been great, right? That shouldn't be in doubt. That shouldn't be in the question, right? The problem right now is that the progressive problem is that we can't seem to hold that notion at the same time with the notion that maybe we also have to recast the role of boys and men at the same time, right? Like gender equality doesn't have to go only one way, right? Like recognizing some of the structural challenges that boys and men face also. And if you see the way he presents, and the reason why I'm convinced, and there's something we've talked about before, is he does a pretty even-handed approach with the conservative side, right? He's quite clear that he's not a fan of the more traditional conservative view, right? Because besides fueling it for political gain, besides overweighing the importance of biology, really what the promise is for men and boys in the conservative sense is going back to what it used to be, right? Which is clearly very regressive, right? And that clearly isn't a solution to the problems that we face right now. In fact, the way he frames it towards the end, he says, progressives see any move to provide more help to boys and men as a distraction from the fight for girls and women. And then conservatives see any move to provide more help to girls and women as motivated by a desire to put men down, right? And what I was most convinced by in the book is this notion, we can pay attention to the structural problems that are faced by boys and men without giving up, or even without compromising, or even without changing the way we approach the gender equality movement vis-a-vis the direction of women and girls in general. Yeah.
Hey, just going back to the point on toxic masculinity as well, I think the way that he framed it was that we are pathologizing the naturally occurring aspects of male identity, or like parts of masculinity that are sort of inherent in the identity. I don't actually agree that that's what toxic masculinity is sort of framed to be. I think the way that I've understood toxic masculinity is more of condemning certain behaviors that arise out of these identities rather than the identities themselves. So for example, if a man were to sexually harass a woman, we would condemn that behavior as toxic masculinity, not the fact that maybe males have higher sex drives than women on average. Yeah. So I think framing it in a different way would maybe make it clearer where the fault or the problem lies.
Yeah.
What I think still remains is, how do we engage in these sort of conversations or this discourse about toxic masculinity in a way that doesn't alienate men?
Yep.
Because I do agree that when you call something out as toxic, it immediately puts the person on the receiving end off, in that there's, I think the way that Reese framed it was that it makes the person feel like there's something in them to be exorcised.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely not the best way to approach constructive problem solving in any case. So I would be interested if any men are out there who want to pitch in on how we can, I guess, approach this in a more empathetic and kind way. I would be interested to know how that would look like.
So let's pick up from the empathy point, right? Because it's such a big point, both in terms of not just talking about empathy, but having conversations about it with men and boys. It's such an important point to get a socialization point in the context of the family that it's a bit surprising that the book doesn't talk about it, right? So it's very clear that this is a problem, but its solutions don't really talk about it. The solutions are very focused on policies, but not really the softer side of, or the fuzzier side of, changing culture and society. I think that's one critique I have. The other one, and in this section, we kind of want to segue in talking about the critiques we have, but also the applicability of the Singapore context. And I can fuse both at the same time, because my second critique of the book is that I'm based in the US, yes, but the book is very parochial. It's obviously written for a US audience, maybe a Western audience. You will find the book very ludicrous if you're reading it from a country where women's rights are systemically denied, and then, you know, where girls can't go to school, when clearly very aggressive as well, very patriarchal arrangements which probably persist in many, many different countries around the world. Clearly, this book is not meant for that context also. And then, you know, which is why I think there's value in thinking about how much it applies to Singapore. But before talking about Singapore, I'm interested to hear any kind of other problems or critiques that you had when you were reading the book.
I'm really going ham on the book right now.
Well, we talked about the good parts, right? So kind of balancing it out in that sense.
Like, we enjoyed it, but...
Yes.
I think for me, what I've already mentioned was that I think it's unclear where the responsibility of addressing these sort of systemic or structural faults lie. Is it with individuals? Is it with women? Is it with men themselves? And when it comes to cases of bad behavior, then what are the corrective actions that would be more appropriate to take? Because I think right now, it's a lot about penalizing men. It's a lot about, I think, harsher punishments or even the way that I think social media deals with it. It's a lot of naming and shaming.
Yep.
So how do we approach this in a more constructive way that sort of brings men as a collective along on the journey? I think also his policy recommendations, they focus a lot on helping boys from a young age or preparing future generations for a world that is changing because of changing expectations for both genders. But I saw less of a focus on what men are struggling with currently. So for example, he mentioned things like, I think it's a commonly known fact that a lot of men, there are higher rates of suicide among men.
Yep.
And struggle with the problem of loneliness. A lot of them maybe don't have that much of a motivation to move out of their parents' house, and therefore like their social lives are very circumscribed in that way. I think those are important points that Reeves did not address. And I think, at least for me, from my vantage point, I see that becoming more of a problem in Singapore as well. So I would have wanted a bit more texture, a bit more meat to be given to topics like that.
No, that whole point, so I should reframe it. The question about who is responsible is a really, I didn't quite think about it extensively, but the way you framed it makes a lot of sense, right? Because you could be, and maybe you had the same feeling, which is you as female, you read the book and you're like, so am I responsible for changing these things? Either for my partner,
I think, or that's for where the indignation came as well. I was right. Like, wait, we worked so hard to put ourselves up there and try to push for women's rights, but now we have to look back and be like, okay, men, come along with us.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can see, because when you say that, I was like, yeah, exactly right. Because the question I think about social change is also tied to who is responsible, right? Because we, throughout our conversation today, we talked about, is it the women? Is it the family around them? Is it extended family members? Is it themselves, right? I don't know if I have the answer, but what I do have is very clear link to Singapore, right? Because this came out, I think, about a week ago, and we're recording this on July 15th. This is a news article that came out in the Straits Times, and the headline says, living alone, a risk factor for social isolation, especially for men. And it's a study by NUS. And what's interesting about the study, and I'm quoting directly here, right, is that, yes, they find the same study, right? They find the same finding about how, you know, living alone is a risk factor for social isolation, especially for men. But this is a very interesting quote in the article that says this, and I quote verbatim. However, people who are living together with family may also develop social disconnection, especially those who are unhealthy and uneducated, right? So, end quote. And that's pointing to just complicating your question even further, right? Because just saying who might not be enough, because we could say, oh yes, we need the family to do a better job. But this study, I think, is an example of even just specifying who is involved is not enough, right? We need to specify, I feel, configurations, right? And also steps, right? Like what exactly needs to be done, right? Clearly that's not beyond the scope of the book. I don't think he maybe did chose not to deal with it because it's so knotty and complicated and very hard to untangle, but you know, and this is clearly difficult, but I'm wondering what your sensing is, right? Like, how do we approach this question of who is responsible? How do we configure that social support system? And how do we start thinking, or how do we even start thinking about redefining roles and responsibilities of men in Singapore?
Yeah, I think that's probably why Reeves is so focused on policies or changing structures for boys, because it is always, I think, easiest to start from like parenting, because that's where it's the like boys would be the most malleable, the most receptive to all these sort of norms that you want to put in place. Whereas when you grow older, it's just so much harder to engage in these sort of conversations and change behaviors. Just to bring in a bit of Gen Z-ness into this conversation, I remember seeing this TikTok where this lady was saying, if parents say boys are so much easier to raise, it's because they're waiting for their future girlfriends to do the parenting. Which I found pretty accurate in some ways, because a lot of the emotional labor of changing behaviors then falls onto the partners of these men. And it is a lot of effort that goes into it. And as you said, like, it really depends on like who the men surrounds themselves with and how they can influence them to make that change. But on the point on, I guess, men facing more loneliness and isolation in a modern context, even when they live with family members, I think that's also where the vulnerability is, because that's where they may be more susceptible to the rhetoric of Andrew Tate types or Jordan Peterson types. And that's also, I think they build a lot of resentment towards women when they feel like they're not being included in the considerations around policies or social conversations about toxic masculinity, that sort of thing.
We promised we'll come back to this earlier, right? But I feel like it's an opportune time to talk about, not opportune, but an appropriate time to think about or to talk about national service, right? Because I've had some, interactions and by volunteering with Aware before in the past, and a lot of the questions that will come up, right, and you alluded to this in the beginning, is conversations in Singapore, even without the men piece, right, but just talking about women's rights and feminism in general, it's always met with the same response, right? It's like, okay, but like,
do you want gender equality? Right? We already have NS.
Right? That somehow doing NS, I mean, let's not talk about the xenophobia and then the national identity tied to it. Just focus on the gender piece, right? Which is somehow doing or completing NS somehow means there is no gender inequality in Singapore, right? It's obviously not true, but that's the narrative that's persistent, right? Every single time, even if Aware is advocating for something that's not, maybe something related to low-income moms, for instance, right? It comes, but what about a group for men? Like, why don't we have a group for men? And I'm interested to hear, what your interactions have been and what your thoughts are on this.
I was joking with a friend recently that since there is an Aware for women, that should be an Unaware for men. I'm sorry, I'm bringing terrible jokes. But I do find the conversation as can go both ways. One is the way you mentioned, in that there's really gender equality because there's NS for men. In fact, it is biased against men or discriminates against men, and women have it so much better in Singapore. The other one is that men recognize that gender equality inequality exists, and it discriminates against women, but they are reluctant to make any more concessions because of NS. And I think those two conversations can be approached in very different ways. I think for the latter one, which is what I've heard more of, then it becomes very reductive, because women will be like, but we have pregnancy penalties, for example. We are out of work for a certain time because we have to take care of the child. Yep. And there's a lot of time and effort put into caregiving. And then it evolves into, but then what about single women, women who never have children? What penalties are they paying?
Yeah.
And so I think reframing the concept, or like taking a step back, it's like, why are we so focused on making sure that it's like a tit for tat sort of state of play here, in that if men suffer in one way, women have to suffer in another way, and then we try to like equalize it in that sense. Rather, like, why are we not thinking of, okay, since NS obviously is not going away, how do we ensure that men don't lose out in other ways, or they're not the penalties that that stem from NS, maybe like taking 2 years out of joining the workforce or joining university or enrolling for college, does not result in that much penalties or harm for them. I think that's a better way to approach the conversation, in a way that doesn't entirely shut it down, because we're dealing with so many factors that are out of our control. Like,
yep,
the government is definitely not going to take away NS anytime soon, and they've already said that NS will not be extended to women because women will then be put out of the labor market for 2 years, and that will result in labor shortages. So I think dealing with the facts of the matter and then trying to get the best outcomes for both parties is the way I see the solution going forward.
Yeah, and I think so too. I mean, part of it is I have colored tinted perspectives because I think a lot of it is correlated with the amount of resentment you have with as a Singaporean male, the amount of resentment you have with the system. And I'll be the first to admit I don't have the same degree of resentment, right? Like, would I prefer not to do it? Yeah, obviously. But I don't have a lot of complaints about it, but I can also see folks who have a lot more resentment. And I think some of it is pretty legitimate, which is what you say, right? Which is that a separate conversation to be had about, are there ways in which we can improve? Even we've assumed that, conscription is necessary. Are there ways in which we can minimize the loss, the two-year loss, or improve the way in which the conscription is done? I think there are ways to go about doing so. And that requires separate conversation altogether. In the context of feminism and gender equality, I think that's also not a worthwhile pursuit, right? In reflecting and looking back at the conversation we've been having, I'm partial to kind of two ways to think about it, right? I guess the one thing that, and I'm trying to take a more positive light here in the Singapore context, one is that I'm 32, I have friends who are getting married or are married in very stable relationships, and they demonstrate very good examples of how it is like to distribute roles and responsibilities, right? Most of the time, they are both working. Most of the time, household chores are very evenly spread out. It's very clear there's no trouble with it. In fact, some might take the step further to confront or reflect the way in which their own parents have manage the household, and they are like, hey, this seems pretty messed up that mom had to do all these things and work at the same time and dad just came back and sat at the couch and did nothing, right? So I think more demonstrations or conversations about what does a healthy distribution of labor in a household look like? This is before having children, right? Because that's a separate conversation. But what does it look like to be in a healthy, stable relationship where both parties pull their weight outside the household, inside the household? And there's so many examples of it. And I think in a more heartening way, that feels to be more common now than it used to be, say, 10, 20 years ago. I think that's one. I think the other piece, which is related, is what does it mean to be a father, right? I can't speak to this because I'm not one. I have studied fatherhood and parenting, but what does it mean to be a father, right? Rhys in the book talks a lot about fatherhood through policies and institutions, but I also think about what does it mean to be a good dad in general, right? What kinds of role models do we have about fathers in Singapore? I might be wrong. I'm happy to be corrected, but I struggle to identify, a very healthy kind of father figure. I don't want to make it about popular culture all the time, but, we're just watching Modern Family, and in that show, there is a very clear father figure who demonstrates all the positive traits of what it means to be a cool dad, what it means to be a dad who is willing to say sorry to your child or children if you mess up.
Phil Dunphy,
yeah. So he's not perfect, right? But what does it mean to be, in the 21st century? What does it mean to be a good father, right? I don't think we have a lot of examples in Singapore like that, right? Again, I'm happy to be corrected, but what does it mean to raise your children and child as a good father and while having to balance all these, right? To tag team with your partner. I think having those demonstrations would be really great, right? Rather than just saying, oh, we're so happy to have a child and all these things, but what's the day-to-day experience like? And I, again, see so many of these positive demonstrations by my friends. Like, you see them in, Instagram photos and stories and Facebook posts, and they must be doing something right. And so I feel like if we want to change the socialization part of it, if we can start rethinking or presenting more positive household configurations and more positive notions of what it means to be involved, engaged, responsible father, besides just bringing in money and income and being the breadwinner, then that would be, at least a step. Doesn't quite answer the who and who is going to be involved and how the configuration will look like, but at least we are going somewhere. Yeah.
No, for sure. I fully agree. I think our generation doesn't have, and for full disclosure, I am 27 years old this year, so we are part of the same generation.
I think so.
I think our generation definitely doesn't have a positive role model for fathers. And I guess what a good split of responsibilities looks like in a nuclear family. And I think the role of domestic workers further complicates it, because in Singapore, we have this structure where it's very common for families to have a live-in domestic worker who is I think will be female. Like, I've never seen a male domestic worker live with a family. It's always a female, and that creates this, it complicates it because you have this permanent female role that is just solely for caregiving and taking care of the household chores. And that sets an example, not only for the parents, but also for the children growing up. And yep. I think our generation is the generation that is experimenting with what is it like to do away with these typical traditional structures that we've been so used to growing up. And I think there's a lot of calibration that is required as well, because, like, as you mentioned, it's not only men who, when, or not only boys who experience this sort of like coddling growing up. In Singapore, I think it's women as well. And so I think it's really an experiment in trying to figure out what works for that family, especially when kids come along. Yeah. And what is considered an even split? Because I think that's something that the book pointed out as well, is the research that was done. Gender equality doesn't mean that you put in the same amount of effort at every point in time. It could be that at the start of taking care of a kid, when you have a baby, the mom plays a bigger role in caregiving, precisely because she's able to provide things that the father cannot. But as the child grows up, maybe the father plays a bigger role in doing things like picking the kids up, making sure that administrative things like scheduling dental appointments are all taken care of. And that's when the father really steps up and plays a bigger role in the child's life. Yeah. So I think that's maybe how we can approach that conversation on what looks like an even split within nuclear families in Singapore. But I do think we're at a very nascent stage where we're still trying to grapple with what is it like to not have a live-in maid in our house? Yeah. And how do we deal with that, given that it's a dual-income household?
Yeah. No, that's such an important point. I never thought about, I mean, I know the prevalence of live-in domestic workers. I have very strong personal opinions against it, but I understand that to be the norm. So yeah. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that as well. I understand that to be very prevalent, not the norm, to be very prevalent. And then that's not something I thought about as well. I mean, the other related piece would be, you know, the role of extended family members, right? And that's very important, because I think as a way to kind of put the discussion together, I would love for you to have the last word, but from what I see, right, because our contribution to the book and in the Singapore context is adding on to something that Reeves concludes with. And I'm going to quote him and add on, I think, what are some of the points that you and I have discussed that I think are worth thinking about, right? So he concludes with quite a powerful epilogue, and he says this and this, and I quote, he says, doing more for boys and men does not require an abandonment of the ideal of gender equality. In fact, it is a natural extension of it. The problem with feminism as a liberation movement, he says, is not that it has gone too far. It is that it has not gone far enough. Women's lives have been recast, men's lives have not. And I think in the Singapore context, the big thing that I took away from today came from you, which is, if we want to start thinking about recasting the lives of men, a big part of the conversation has to be about who is responsible, right? So is it the prevalence of domestic workers? Is it norms surrounding extended family members that have not been changed? Is it with men ourselves, which is still thinking that the way in which we were raised should be the way we raise our children and conduct ourselves, right? In the household especially. And so that question about who is responsible, but beyond who, something else we discuss and add on to the discussion is, what would the configuration look like, right? So who needs to pull together? What kinds of conversations we need to have? What kinds of role models do we need to look up to? What kinds of models or what kinds of, you know, structures or systems that we need to do away with? I don't think we have an answer to that. But at least I think in the Singapore context, I think thinking about who we want to target is going to be a really important one. Yeah. And so I turn over to you to kind of have the last word for our chat today.
Yeah, no, I actually really like the way that Reeves sort of framed it, in that this conversation that we're having about what gender equality looks like for men is a corollary to the conversation about feminism or the women's movement. And he framed it as, what we need is a positive vision of masculinity that is compatible with gender equality. And I think this book is so important, with, like, for all its shortcomings. And of course, like, a book like that wouldn't be able to address all the issues that are out there. But I do think it's still an important book, because it does start the conversation on how do we approach all these problems, like you said, who is responsible for it, and how do we then go out there and implement it. So yeah, I think there's still a lot of value to be extracted from this book, but it obviously doesn't, the conversation doesn't end here. And in fact, I think this has sort of opened up new ways of thinking for us. And I think we can get a lot of value in continuing this discussion with other people.
Yeah. And, you know, for the listeners, if this is the first time we're trying this, and so, you know, if you made it this far, many of you will, if you made it this far, we'd love to hear suggestions. Are there books we should read? We have a list. What did you think about the episode? Are there things that you think we should structure differently as well? We're going to try. I think I speak for Estella, where I would say we have a really good time, not just with this actual discussion, but in thinking about it, I think this forces us to kind of read the book in greater detail and look through it over time. And so if you have any comments, any suggestions, feel free to let us know. I will be happy to work with them. Yeah. And thank you, Estella. I think this is really fun. So we look forward to maybe doing another one down the road or so.
Yeah. I think just an additional note, we chose this book precisely because we thought it would be sort of a spicy discussion to have. So if you have any books that you think might be thought-provoking in this respect, I think we would really appreciate that.